hundreds of miles. It's a thrilling performance in a movie that's good, but not up to its star. That's mainly Cheadle's fault, too. He's also the director and co-screenwriter with Steven Begelman. But you can sympathize. In interviews, he said he couldn't get financing without a white co-star. That turned out to be Ewan McGregor, who plays a journalist writing an article about Davis's 5-year disappearance from the music scene in the 1970s. No knock on McGregor, but the story is a little stale. It's set at the end of that 5-year absence, and turns on a session tape Davis has supposedly just made that his record company wants and a nefarious manager steals, which prompts Miles to do a lot of raging and gun-waving. There's even a car chase. Davis was a recluse for 5 years, but none of the rest actually happened. It's a fantasy, which wouldn't matter if it were compelling, which it isn't. Here's what's good in Miles Ahead. Everything else. Freed from standard biopic conventions, Cheadle focuses on one window of time, with plenty of space for flashbacks to the late 50s and 60s. The gist is that Davis never recovered from the loss of his wife, the dancer Frances Taylor, played by the magnetic actress Emiyatsi Corinaldi, who flees when the cocaine-addled Miles, after cheating on and beating her, pulls a gun and hunts phantom intruders. Talking to McGregor's journalist, Miles weaves memories of their relationship through thoughts on his own artistic evolution, his high rasp uncannily like Miles's own voice.
So, studied piano too, huh?
Nah, just woke up black, know how to play.
You're black? Is it cool?
Go ahead. Frances loves Chopin.
Yeah, she looks like a classy chick.
That's all you ever play at the house, you know, classical music. Chopin, Stravinsky. You know, we throw on some Ravel. I studied all them cats, man. Broke down their compositions. These revolutionaries, innovators, pushing back at that standard classical bag. Chopin, it's all about improvisation. Bird and Diaz was doing that on stage every night, on the fly. Didn't write it down. I wanted to quit every night. You know, old people, they come up to me and they say, "Why don't you play like you used to?" I say, "Tell me how I used to." It takes a long time to be able to play like yourself. Man, don't do nothing like you used to. The music don't move on and it's dead music, you know. It's just dead.
In Miles Ahead, Davis is dissipated by illness and addiction, but still burning hot. Too hot to settle into existing musical forms. It's Cheadle's most electrified performance since the one that made him a star, the incorrigibly homicidal Mouse in the 1995 mystery Devil in a Blue Dress. As director, his style is jazziest when he travels into the past, when Miles' memories drift in on a wave of blue notes and cigarette smoke. We see him bend bandmates like Bill Evans and Herbie Hancock to his will, but also give them room to find their own pulse. There's also an extraordinary turn by Keith Stanfield as an arrogant young trumpeter. Stanfield played a fiercely hurting teenage rapper in Short Term 12 and looks more and more like a major actor. Everything that's great in Miles Ahead is marginal to the plot, but those margins are spacious enough to let Cheadle, as director and actor, go with the flow. I'd like to think even the unruly, perfectionistic Miles Davis would give at least a nod of approval.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's Fresh Air, a former interrogator in Abu Ghraib prison, we talk with Eric Fair, who says he doesn't consider what he did enhanced interrogation. He considers it torture, and he deeply regrets his actions, even though he didn't commit any of the worst abuses. His new memoir is Consequences. Hope you can join us. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from Abrams, publisher of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series and the hosts of a live webcast with author Jeff Kinney on April 28th. More information is available at wimpykid.com.
Texas singer Maren Morris came into her own as a songwriter in Nashville.
At the time, I didn't consider myself an artist, but with that song, it all changed. Can I get a
hallelujah? Now her next album is one of country's most anticipated debuts. Hear why later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, at the heart of every successful project, organization, family, and relationship, working together is critical. Evening at Egan presents Strengthening the Spirit of Collaboration. At 9:30, vacations matter for productivity, happiness, family bonding, and especially health. Great Vacation Squeeze makes the case for more vacation time. Gavel Alaska returns at 10. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Good afternoon to you. It's Friday's edition of A Juno Afternoon, and I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. We're going to be talking to photographer Skip Scheel today about his film screening and talk on Gaza's and Israel's neighbors, Other Voice. We're going to talk to JPD Lieutenant Chris Sell about the Saturday presentation, Hope, Not Heroin. Rhonda Gardner is going to be here from the Juno Co-op Preschool, and she's going to be talking about Saturday's not-so-silent film showing. And we're going to get a preview of this weekend's Juno Student Symphony performances. That's all happening, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, fun, more, surprises, maybe, I don't know. It's all happening, though, coming up right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A proposal to change the name of Harney Peak in the Black Hills of South Dakota is up to a federal board. The board could rule as early as April 14th. As Victoria Wicks reports, a Native leader says no matter what the decision is, First People will always think of the peak by its traditional Native name.
For hundreds and maybe thousands of years, you know, we call this place Hihankara, meaning making of the owl.
Russell Eagle Bear speaks at the number 9 trailhead at the mountain now known as Harney Peak.
Following my elders, we're still going to continue calling this Hihankara Paha, but we can certainly live with Black Elk also.
Black Elk Peak is just one suggestion put forth by advocates wanting to remove the name of the U.S. Army general who led an 1855 massacre at Blue Water Creek in Nebraska. 86 Sechangu and Oglala people, including women and children, were killed. The South Dakota Board on Geographic Names initially recommended changing the name to Hihankaga, but the difficulty of pronouncing it was one factor ultimately leading the board to rescind its decision and recommend leaving the name as it is. Lou Yost is executive director for the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. He says the state board's recommendation is just one factor the federal board considers. He says feds take input from state and county officials and from tribes with current and historical interest in the area. Since the peak is on U.S. Forest Service land, that agency weighs in as well. Yost says the deadline for feedback has now passed.
We will present it to the board, and if they don't have any questions that we don't have answers for, then it would be a final decision. If someone makes a motion to defer it for whatever reason, then it could get pushed to another month or two.
Yost says the board could decide to let the name stay as it is or choose between Thunder Peak or Black Elk Peak. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Voting advocates are working to get out the Native vote. The Native American Voters Alliance hosted a voter engagement convention this week in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Director of the Alliance, Lori Wiaki, says efforts include helping advocates find messages to reach Native voters, to not only register them, but help get them to the polls.
In the Native community, there's historical mistrust that I think we've been working for many years to overcome, and I think a lot of people are seeing some results with that in terms of, you know, really being able to articulate the reasons we need to vote is really about creating a better future for ourselves and our children. And that depends on, you know, whether or not we have access to resources. Are those resources being fairly put to our communities and to our concerns?
Voting advocates say it's best to localize and find out what issues and concerns can engage voters. For example, people in a tribal community may be fighting for water or looking to improve education. One issue the Jicarilla Apache Nation in northern New Mexico is interested in is securing more capital outlay funding from the state. Annette Martinez is the tribe's public relations officer. She says they started voter registration drives last fall, as well as created pamphlets, a monthly newsletter, and have used the tribe's radio station and newspaper to inform voters.
The main thing they tell us is, my one vote don't count. I was like, it does count. It does. And we had to emphasize it again. All together, all of us, we could be one strong voice. It's not just us also. It's the Rio Ripa County's clerk's office. They're always informing us constantly, you guys are the biggest vote base up there. They say you could have a lot of power, you know, if you all came out to vote. And they're constantly telling us this. And we're trying to put that message in the ears of our voters.
Martinez says the last voter turnout was low, with about 300 people, compared to previous years like 2008, where more than 900 of the tribe's 1,400 registered voters turned out. Voting advocates say casting a ballot is just one way to make change in tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support by VisionMaker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. On February 20th, VisionMaker Media celebrates 40 years of advancing Native culture, heritage, wisdom, sacred stories, and the storyteller. More at visionmakermedia.org. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Clink! Over 50 wines from around the world are waiting to be sampled. Tuesday, April 5th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., join Juno Arts and Humanities for this annual wine tasting event with music by Traveler Duo and additional refreshments throughout the evening. Single, couples, and reserve table seating tickets are available, and proceeds benefit the Jack. Champagne, Pinot Noir, Sauvignon Blanc, and more. Tickets and a full list of wines at jahc.org. Tune in to KRNN for live broadcasts from the 42nd Annual Alaska Folk Festival, April 4th through the 10th. This live broadcast is made possible by the generous sponsorship of Southeast Radiation Oncology Center, bringing hope to cancer patients in Southeast Alaska, offering radiation therapy and patient support services. And Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, featuring locally roasted coffees, fresh baked pastries, and breakfast and lunch options at the Downtown Cafe.
And welcome back to the Juno Afternoon Studios. Andy Klein with you, your host for today. And with us right now is photographer Skip Scheel for a second visit back into the studio. Skip, thanks so much for coming in. Elaine Schroeder is also here from the Juno People for Peace and Justice. And Elaine, thanks for coming in. And
Good. You've
helped organize this showing of Skip's film, Gaza's Israeli Neighbors. So tell me, first of all, well, there's a connection here, right?
There's a slight connection. Skip Scheel's my brother. We grew up together in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, and then in a suburb. And Skip comes to visit, and he actually gives these shows all around the country. So Juno's just one of many places. He just came from California where he gave a show. So it works out perfectly because I do the promo, and Skip does a show,
sure.
And it's good.
And why not? You know, yeah, if you have a talented sibling. Why not get them to talk here when they come visit?
Yeah. And a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
It's cool.
So, Skip, thanks for coming back in again. And you, let's talk first. You did a slideshow and talk last week, right, or the beginning of this week. Was it Monday?
Yeah.
It was Monday, yeah,
right.
Here at the 360 Studios. How'd that go?
I think it went very well. It was called Timeline, Palestine, Israel, an overview of the history going back 125 years. And so I outlined that, and then we discussed various aspects of the story.
Yeah, great. And so this is a related theme, this project coming up next. So tell me a little bit about what people can expect in this. This is a film that we're talking about now for Gaza's Israeli neighbors.
It's about a group that live within a mile of Gaza, and therefore they're heavily attacked. And they, this particular group called Other Voice, has organized to advocate for a nonviolent resolution of the conflict, which means diplomacy, talks, not tanks, not wars. And they've existed for about 7 years. And I visit them periodically, and I try to experience what they experience, because a missile could fall at any moment, shot from Gaza. And also, what kind of reaction? I'm interested in the reaction they get from their own Israeli neighbors, since they're a small group.
And what is some of that reaction that they get?
It varies. Generally, it's relatively accepting. I wouldn't say positive. There are conflicts within the family, and I've explored that a little bit. Husbands and daughters, in one case, didn't agree at all with the Other Voice member in their family, but supported her. And range from that all the way to a fairly violent reaction, where a peace bus they helped organize came to one of the communities, the Israeli communities, and it was attacked, I think, with stones and shouts and needed police intervention. Mm. That's unusual, though.
Yeah, but there is that kind of that potential undercurrent there of people not wanting to necessarily hear that message. From this group, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, it strikes me that you were just saying, Elaine, that you guys grew up in a kind of a working class Chicago
mm-hmm.
family,
yeah.
And now but you also said we may not look alike, but you can tell we're from the same family. The advocacy, you know, kind of flag raises high.
Yeah, both of us are activists.
Yeah. So, why do you think that is?
We were discussing that today, and. Really, we could make up an answer like our mother took in orphans, which is true. And, you know, we could make up some kind of answer. We had wonderful parents. They're really great folks. But there is no answer. We are not red diaper babies. We grew up in a kind of a normal family. Parents were Republicans at first and then became Democrats. So it could be just a total coincidence. I don't know. But it sure makes it easy to be siblings, because we're just one brother and one sister. We don't have any other siblings. And our parents died a long, 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 long time ago when they were, you know, not that old.
So even if you don't necessarily agree specifically on every single issue, you understand the passion that each other has.
I think we agree on almost every issue, probably. Uh-huh.
The 60s influenced me, and Vietnam in particular. So that's when I began my activism. Elaine is 4 years younger, so I'm not sure she had that same influence, but we both were coming to awareness during the 60s.
What was your experience during the 60s? What was sort of your personal experience that made you?
Well, I was in college, and my first organizing effort, which I think I did solo until I found more people, was about the Mekong River, which runs through Vietnam, Cambodia, and other areas. And those were zones of conflict in the early 60s. The U.S. didn't go to war until 1965 with Johnson. But I thought the Mekong River could be an example of cross-border sharing. And so I organized, I think it was at University of Washington at that time. But then by 65, I was in graduate school and subject to the draft if I left graduate school, and I did. And so I had to decide how I would respond to the possibility of becoming a soldier. and I decided to become a conscientious objector. So it was more than an intellectual pursuit. It was a very practical question for me.
Mm. And you were going to answer part of that yourself. Is that
I was at University of Illinois when the war started, and I was married, and the same guy I'm married to now, and we were both very strong anti-war activists, and then we went into Peace Corps. And some people got and my husband applied for CO, conscientious objector status. So you can see all the similarities. But we were in Peace Corps for 2-3 years.
Where were you in the Peace Corps?
India. Hmm. And then when we got back, we were at University of Washington in graduate school. And then I was very, very active in opposing the Vietnam War. And it was the beginning of the women's movement, so the two were happening together.
So it just sort of created this thing. Now, Skip, how did you go from the kind of how did you start concentrating on this specific issue, Gaza-Israeli, relationships with Palestine, with all the kind of conflict that happens there? How did that become a focus for you?
Well, two pivotal factors were Jesus Christ and South Africa. So for the first, I was raised Catholic, as Elaine was, and I remember images of Jesus in the Holy Land, and there was just something about that that was magnetic for me, and I'm pretty sure from a very early age I wanted to go there to walk in his footsteps. That later evolved to see what he would have seen if he were alive and ask myself, how would he respond to the conflicts there? So that remains a major factor. And when I go back, I visit the holy sites. I like to stay in Bethlehem, Jerusalem, etc. South Africa, because I was there in 90 and 98, both before and after the end of apartheid. And as apartheid was ending, I began to understand the similarities between the struggles in South Africa against apartheid and the Palestinian struggles for human rights in Israel-Palestine. So I tuned in to Palestine-Israel. And I learned about it, attended talks and watched movies and read books. And I became so enraged that I could have been explosive and dangerous to other people. And I realized somehow, I'm not sure how, that the main way I could deal with this rage was to do something about it. Awareness was not enough. I had to act. And that meant photography, and that meant going there to photograph. And I did not want to go there. It was and is mm-hmm. scary. I could lose my life. I could be injured. I could be detained or arrested by the Israelis or kidnapped in Gaza. So it took me, I'd say about a year to find a way to go. And I eventually went for the first time in 2003.
Do you still have that feeling that you don't want to go there, or has that changed?
Yes. No, it hasn't changed. In fact, it's deepened. And I quote one of my favorite gospel passages, which comes from the mouth of Jesus Christ, allegedly. He's resurrected. He comes back. He meets with some of his disciples, who, by the way, all became martyrs. I don't know if people are aware of that. They all died for the faith. And he says to them, when you are young, you will set your course, strengthen yourself, and go where you wish. However, when you are old, you will reach out your arms, something or someone will strengthen you, and you will be carried where you do not wish to go. And I feel both carried and to a place I would rather not go to.
I mean, it's fascinating to hear you. That's something I haven't heard too many people who are advocating for something or who travel to an area or have a specific area of expertise or study. I've rarely heard them say, you know, I don't really want to go there.
He's been doing it for 13 years.
Yeah.
Every year, pretty much?
On average, every year and a half.
It must be a little nerve-wracking for family as well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the first time I went, we had a Last Supper, a quote-unquote Last Supper for me. And I was really worried, and my family was really worried. And we got all together, and we were sitting around the table, and we said, hey, this is like the Last Supper. I hope the next step doesn't happen for you, my father, my former husband, et cetera. And so, I'm over some of that. But one has to decide, hearkening to some of the words of Martin Luther King, what we're willing to die for. And he said, those who have nothing they're willing to die for are not fit to live. And so I have to think, well, is this really of that much importance to me? And I've been in threatening situations there, and I'm usually pretty calm about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how people can see the film. We haven't talked about the details of that. So it's happening. Would you want to go through it, Derek?
Sure.
It's happening coming up April 3rd.
Sure, let me go through it. And so this coming Sunday, April 3rd, 7 p.m. at Northern Light United Church, it's free. And Skip is going to show his 36-minute, roughly that long, film in process, and then we're going to have a discussion afterwards. And I must admit, I got a preview of the film, and it's really exciting to see these Israelis who are more threatened by the occasional rockets that come over, and then there's a fear. You know, they may be occasional, but you never know when.
Sure.
And speaking so eloquently about their determination that the way to peace is not through retaliation. And then you also hear from a Palestinian over the phone, of course, because the group, Other Voice, if they have Palestinian members, as I understand it, if they can't get together.
They have one Palestinian member.
Okay.
But conditions in Gaza are extremely different from those in Israel. So even though there are problems, growing problems in Israel with shutting people, dissidents down, in Gaza, one could lose one's life by any connection with Israelis, let alone calling for negotiations rather than rockets.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. We could obviously continue to talk about this, but we've got some other guests we have
to get to.
But thanks so much. It's happening April 3rd. It's at Goldtown.
This Sunday, April 3rd. It's at Northern Light United Church. 7 p.m. And it's free.
Sounds great.
So please come.
Skip Scheel, thanks so much. Elaine, thanks so much for coming in as well. And have a great showing of your film, and great talking to you again.
Thank you, Andy.
Okay. Thank you, Andy.
Welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and joining me now is Lieutenant Chris Sell from JPD. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Sure, thanks for inviting me.
Really appreciate you having you here. You've got a presentation coming up on Saturday that really is dealing with a subject that's really hitting home in Juno, especially it seems like in the last few years the issue of heroin has really kind of come to the forefront. Maybe some of that's education, and maybe some of that's the drug being more prevalent, but this is called Hope, Not Heroin.
It's better than a presentation. It's like the best presentation you could imagine, because it's more like a celebration, and it's a celebration emphasizing that there is hope for this issue. It's a difficult situation that Juno finds itself in right now, along with cities all across the country. Is that we've got a heroin problem. We've got a drug problem in general, and we have heroin being particularly lethal in that environment. So we're facing the same challenges as a lot of communities, and this rally wraps up the Juneau Police Department's six-month anti-heroin push that we launched at the 1st of October last fall, after we had had seven fatalities in 2015. So we started this anti-heroin initiative. We wanted to wrap it up in a big way. And when we would talk to families and we would talk to people who were even interested in recovery, we found that it was very difficult for them to get information about what are the next steps. If they know someone who's decided to get off heroin, where do you go from there? And this is often a person and even family members that have been really overwhelmed with the demands of having this addiction in their lives. So we wanted to make it easy, that we're going to put everything in one place for people to come and see what resources are out there, have people to talk to who've been down this road, someone that they can relate to, and to realize that they're not alone, that there are people here that have survived this addiction and can help them.
Mm-hmm. So this is happening tomorrow. It goes from 2 to 6, and where's it going to be?
It's going to be right across the street from where we're sitting right now. It's going to be over at the Jack.
Okay.
Now, I understand that the construction has made this area look a little scary right now, and we don't want anybody to end up with the back of their car facing straight up, falling into one of these big trenches. So I'd like to remind everybody to come in from the Centennial Hall side over by the state office building in Bullwinkles, come in through that parking lot to find parking over by the Jack.
Yeah, I found that out today driving to K2 here.
You still have your car?
I still have my car.
Good.
Everything's fine.
Good. Yes, always obey cones. Cones are our friends.
It's from JPD telling you, always obey cones. So getting back to this very serious subject of heroin use in Juneau, What are some of the ideas behind what's going on? I mean, as you said, it's a nationwide problem that's happening right now. But what are some of the ideas in the field about what's happening? Why is this happening right now?
Well, as far as why it's happening now is that heroin is just readily available. And the supply has been increasing over the years. We get a lot of tar heroin in from Mexico. It's just a readily available drug, less so in Juneau than down south, but still readily available. And then the addiction is so powerful. The addiction gets into people's lives and just trumps everything that they thought was important to them, and their whole lives become about servicing that addiction. So Juneau has, the factor I just mentioned is that our heroin is not cheap compared to down south. That creates both positive and negatives. Expensive heroin is less available for people to experiment. It's less available to kids. However, when you have a point of heroin, which is a standard dosage unit, cost $100 on the streets of Juneau, and it has for years. It's been stable at that. An active user may use anywhere from 1 to 10 points a day. Wow. There's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that same point of heroin, guess for me, if you will, what that would cost on the streets of Seattle if it's $100 in Juneau.
I don't know. $70.
$5.
$5.
$5. So that's why you're really swimming upstream if you're trying to keep people out of the temptation of muling in heroin to service their own addiction, to sell it to other people, because it's just a staggering profit margin with that. And it's also brought in more of a heavily armed type of dealer has come into Juneau in this high profit area. So while the high price of heroin has some advantages, it also has some disadvantages. And as a police department, that we have acknowledged that we can't just keep going after the supply, because every time we pick off a dealer, another desperate person is drawn right back into that high profit zone and their own addiction and will start muling in drugs. So we have acknowledged that we have to go after the demand. If we don't address the demand, we will not be able to make any progress. And it's not like we didn't give it the college try. You know, we spent a few decades on that with the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're acknowledging that it's the demand that fuels this problem. And until we start making advances with the demand, or the supply is going to keep meeting that.
Well, what are some of the forward-thinking ways to deal with that demand?
Some towns have more resources than Juneau's been able to come up with, though we're working in that direction, and we have lots of conversations about the cities that have programs like where someone can just turn themselves into the police, and not for a crime, but to say, I'm an addict, and I want to get help. And there are police departments that can drive them directly to a medical facility that will detox them and work with them during that window that they want to get off the drug. Unfortunately, Juno does not have that instantly available resource. Those are very expensive resources. And what we know is that that window that people run into where they're like, I'm done, I want to get off, doesn't last very long. You may have from anywhere from a few hours to a few days to make progress on that plan before you lose that person, because the withdrawal is so painful
that
from
people
opioids.
Just immediately,
it's very, very rare to die from opioid from opioid withdrawals, but it can certainly make people feel like they're going to die, and they want more than anything in the world to get more of the drug. The drug has really rewired their brains. It's like somebody who's not an addict going out with food for a few days. And then, you know, someone were to tell you, just stop thinking about it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You just got to get off that food. That you wouldn't be able to do that. Well, the addicts have their brain rewired in a similar way. So that has to be something that they're assisted through.
So tell me a little bit about what this whole day is going to look like here.
The whole day. Yeah. Oh, I cannot believe how many people signed up to provide information and to staff tables. At last count, we had 32 organizations, everyone from Bartlett and Rainforest to the Glory Hole to independent counselors who treat people, to people who are experts with the chemical-assisted, the medicine-assisted withdrawals, so that they can talk about the pros and cons of different methods for that. So there's just a lot going on tomorrow. There's also going to be lots of people there who have had their own family members go through this, because it's very isolating sometimes if you have something going on in your family that you just don't want everybody knowing about. When you go to work or you go to Fred Meyer or you go to church, you don't necessarily want to announce to everyone, you know, my son's a heroin addict and I'm really stressed out about it. So there can be a real feel of isolation for people, and it's a huge burden on them. And so this is a safe space where people can talk to someone who can say, you know, my son made it to recovery, or this is what my daughter went through, and this was our experience as a family. I think there's great value in not being left alone with a problem this big.
Are there some numbers? What are some of the statistics right now of people that we think are in this situation of using heroin in Juneau?
You know, it's really difficult to estimate because, darn it, they just don't respond to polls.
Right, yeah.
And whenever we ask people, you know, everyone in the audience who's an addict to raise their hand, nobody does. So we have to do our best with these estimates, talking to medical personnel, counselors, addicts themselves about how many people they know who are taking heroin. And we think it's a conservative estimate to say that 200 people are using heroin every single day in Juneau, doubling to about 400 during the summer when we get in highly paid seasonal workers like in the fishing industry, some of the tourist industries. Those workers are often in the age group of the heaviest drug users, which is, you know, 20 to 40. Kind of in those middle years, you have your heaviest drug use.
And are there good stories? Are there stories of people being able to get out of this?
There are lots of those stories. There are going to be people there who are in long-term recovery who have made it. You know, though they'll tell you, they'll be the first ones to tell you that every single day it's something that they still need to think about, and they still need to take care of themselves very intensely to make sure that that doesn't creep back in their lives. There's also going to be families there who have had family members who have made it. We really wanted to emphasize that there is hope. There are people around this community, scattered all around this community, who have had either them or their family members survive this addiction. So it is a treatable situation, and there is hope out there. And sometimes the addicts don't see it right away. And we actually find that that's a real theme with people who aren't even trying to get off heroin, is that they just believe they're going to use it and then they'll die. And they don't even really care. And we want them to know that there is a way out. And we want their families to know that there's a way out, that this doesn't have to be the end.
Well, it's a great message, and hopefully that's a message that can be spread tomorrow. It's
yes.
happening 2 to 6 over at the Jack, and it's entire, 4 hours of presentations and talks and talking to people who've been through it, and people being able to get help for themselves and their family members or friends. It's called Hope, Not Heroin, and Lieutenant Christelle, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about it.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next is Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 1st of April, 2016, April Fool's Day, day for hoaxes and practical jokes. In the April issue of Sports Illustrated, 1985, George Plimpton reported that the New York Mets had recruited a phenomenal young pitcher who'd learned in a Tibetan monastery. His name was Sid Finch. He could throw a 168-mile-per-hour fastball. The subtitle of the article was, "He's a pitcher, part yogi, and part recluse, impressively liberated from our opulent lifestyle," which spells out Happy April Fool's Day. It's the birthday of the pianist and composer Sergei Rachmaninoff, born in Novgorod, Russia, 1873. He was in the middle of writing his famous second piano concerto when his first symphony got not very good reviews, and he stopped writing music for 3 years. It was a nervous breakdown, and he was finally able to overcome it by visiting a psychiatrist who, each time the two of them met, said the same exact words to Rachmaninoff. He said, "You will write your concerto. You will work with great facility. The concerto will be of excellent quality." It's the birthday of the talk show host Rachel Maddow, born in Castro Valley, California, 1973. Went off to Stanford, went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, earned her doctorate in political science, host of the Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC since 2008, and the author of the book Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power. It's the birthday of the novelist Francine Prose, born Brooklyn, 1947, author of Household Saints, about an Italian butcher and his schizophrenic daughter, and Blue Angel, a satire on academia and writing workshops. Francine Prose, who went to Radcliffe, dropped out of grad school after she read Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel 100 Years of Solitude, which inspired her to write. She's written over 30 books of fiction and nonfiction, including a book on the craft of writing, Reading Like a Writer, in which she advises people who want to be writers to read and to read widely. Her best-selling novel came out a couple of years ago, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It's the birthday of the Czech author Milan Kundera, born in Brno, Czechoslovakia, in 1929, expelled from the Communist Party in the early 1950s, active in the Prague Spring Communist Reform Movement of 1968, left Prague for France in 1975. Best known for his novel The Unbearable Lightness of Being and The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. Here's a poem for today by May Sorton, April in Maine. The days are cold and brown, brown fields, no sign of green, brown twigs, not even swelling, and dirty snow in the woods. But as the dark flows in, the tree frogs begin their shrill, sweet singing, and we lie on our beds through the ecstatic night, wide awake, cracked open. There will be no going back. April in Maine, a poem by May Sarton from her collected poems, published by W.W. Norton and Company, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine,
now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org, and by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Alaska Robotics, featuring comic authors Kate Beaton, Ryan North, Kazuo Kibuishi, and Raina Telgemeier in Juneau this April for a mini-comic convention and artist camp. Registration information at minicon.alaskarobotics.com.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon here. I'm Andy Klein with you, and joining me now is Rhonda Gardner from the Juneau Co-op Preschool, and you've got a really cool event coming up.
We do.
Super fun.
Yep.
It's one of these awesome, I've been to a few of these, they're really cool, they're called the Not So Silent Film, and so there's a live band playing the newly interpreted, that's not a word, but interpreted music
now.
That they play along with the silent film. But this one's really cool because it's all shorts.
Well, it is, and you know, we've been doing some kids' films at the Gold Town this year, and Colette's been letting us use it for a fundraiser, but we've also done these live music and storytelling kids concerts in the past. And so I just thought, what the heck, we'll put them together. And Colette's been trying to fish out look for new musicians to do these not-so-silent films. And this was perfect because instead of an hour and a half of music for a film, it's like, oh, you can come up with 7 minutes of music for a film. So it was pretty great. And the amazing thing, we were talking about this earlier, is I just kept asking people and they kept saying yes. So, you know, I feel like I have this, you know, superstar list of performers we
it
have.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, really is it. It's a who's who of Juneau performers. It's a really cool thing.
Kind of. Yeah. We have 18 musicians, 6 bands, 8 films, and it's can I just go through the list?
Yeah, let's go through it. Let's talk about
what people see. And this isn't necessarily the order. I don't even know if we have an order yet for what we're doing. But Clementine and the Sauerkrauts are Andy Ferguson and Clara, his daughter, who's a preschool alum, and Henry Hopkins. We have the Bonnie Brae Blues Band, which is Mike and Abby Janes, Terry Shores, and I think Andy's jumping in on that too. Another Bonnie Brae-er. We have Pluckster Keaton, which is Amy Houck, Reed Tippetts, John Lager, and myself. Yes, ukuleles will be included.
Mm-hmm.
And and then there's the F Street Trio, which is Colette Costa with Jason Caputo and Libby Sterling. And then my son and his friend, two teenagers, were going to play this little short one, and they were called Teen Sax. But one of them got sick, and so they didn't rehearse, and I kept saying, you know, what's your backup plan? Well, we have a housemate who's in the MAT program for music, Sophia Butler, and she goes, well, I'll play something with you, Reed. So now they're Plan B. That's their band,
Plan B.
So, and then
Plan B sometimes after Teen Sax. It makes
exactly,
sense.
Exactly,
sure.
You know. And then America, it's a preschool event. Come on, Andy.
Preschool
Behave
event.
Yourself.
I'm sorry.
Yes. You don't have to spell it out. And then American Standard is Bob Banghart and Jack Fontanella and Eric Chadwell. So, and they're doing the longest stint. They're
so
doing
the longest is an 18-minute piece.
The guys who've kind of done this kind of thing before. We're leaving the longer ones to the professionals. But the rest of us, there's one Georges Millet clip that is. He's the French filmmaker early 1900s who did the trip to the moon, and he did all these effects and cool stuff, and so that's the shortest one. That's just like a couple minutes. Most of them are about 7 to 9 minutes long, and then American Standard's covering the 18-minuter. Thank goodness.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, like you say, everyone just seemed to say, yeah, that
they just
sounds
kept saying,
good.
Yes, yeah. And, I think it just felt manageable, and it's a pretty forgiving audience. I mean, when you're with, like, parents and preschoolers, it's pretty forgiving. Although, I have to say, I think it's going to be really fun, and even you're welcome to come even if you're unattended by a child.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay.
Unattended adults are welcome. So,
How long do you know about how long you're thinking the performance will be in total?
Well, you know, we haven't all gotten down and all played our things and all together. So there's a little bit of, you know, moving of musicians around. My guess is it'll be about 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Hour
okay.
and a half,
yeah.
You know, we're going to have two shows. So they're both at Gold Town Nickelodeon downtown tomorrow. First show's at 11 o'clock in the morning, and the second show is 5 p.m., trying to span nap time. And and so it's $10 for adults, $5 for children, $28 for a family of four. We don't do, you know, we don't check birth certificates, so your family of four can be made up of, you know, two adults and two kids, however you want to work that. Anybody who's carrying a baby in their arms, they can come in for free. So that's fine. The baby, not the person. Not the person carrying
them. Oh, I thought just if you brought a baby, you get it free.
You bring a baby, you get it. No, you know, actually for a movie, I don't think it works.
No,
even
that's
for us.
Not good.
Yeah, and we'll have snacks. Parents are, you know, making baked goods and things like that, and we'll be making popcorn, and so that'll help. Because it's a fundraiser for preschool. So
yeah. Well, that all sounds amazing. It's the Not So Silent Silly Shorts. Coming up, it's all a fundraiser for the Juno Co-op Preschool.
Yep.
It's happening at the Gold Town Nickelodeon, as Rhonda just said. It's playing tomorrow at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. And it's $10 for adults and $5 for kids and $28 if you're a family of four.
Yeah. Oh, and you can get them online. You kind of have to wiggle around the Gold Town site till you get to the part that's tickets. But, you know, we're out there. Or you can just stop in the theater and she'll take your money and put you on the list.
True. So. I mean, you know, the ones that I've been to, they've sold out, you
well,
know, these not-so-silent
Yeah,
film
we haven't sold out yet, but I think we were pushing halfway through on both shows a couple of days ago. So
worth so checking
get in
out.
There.
Yeah, go
get
to
in
the
there.
Gold Town.
While you're walking around doing your first Friday's thing, just go buy your tickets. And I know I'm not usually happy about rain, but, you know, it's not going to be one of those gorgeous sunny days tomorrow. So you might as well come watch a movie, right?
It's a good day to go see
Listen
a movie.
To music, yeah.
All right. So 11 o'clock in the morning or 5 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, April 2nd. Not So Silent, Silly Shorts. Rhonda Gardner, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Andy.
Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Costello there with B-Movie, celebrating the not-so-silent silly shorts that are going to be coming up tomorrow. That's 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. And we got a little bit of extra time today, so we're going to play a couple of Mudrooms shorts for you to hear. But wanted to let you know about the forecast. Tonight is going to be rain. It's hard to believe that this morning was so gorgeous. And yet, yes, it's Juno. It can find a way to rain in almost any day. So lows around 39 degrees tonight with rain in the forecast. Rain likely tomorrow morning, and then scattered rain showers in the afternoon for Saturday, and highs around 48 degrees. Mostly cloudy for Saturday night, and mostly cloudy for Sunday without too much of a chance, or I guess slight chance of rain on Sunday. So highs around 47 degrees. Heading into Sunday night and Monday, cloudy and still slight chances of rain as well. So that little, you know, that misty stuff, spring weather here happening in Juneau. Well, like I said, we're going to play a couple of mudrooms for you here. First, we're going to hear from the February series of mudrooms. This is a short from India Busby.
India is a radical girl who attends the University of Alaska Southeast and is a barista at COPA. India likes to pretend she knows everything about politics when deep down she's completely clueless about it. Don't actually try and talk to her about politics, though, because she'll just nod her head and pretend she knows what you're talking about. She's on her phone too much and needs to learn that there's a world outside of Twitter. She's also bananas over anything banana flavored. Please welcome India.
Before I tell my story, I just want to let you know that if you feel uncomfortable listening to it, I completely understand. Because I am uncomfortable telling you this story. I've fallen in love twice. The first time was when I was 14 years old. He had short, curly brown hair, beautiful greenish blue eyes, and he had a British accent. And who doesn't love a British accent? So, I had declared that he was my soulmate. So I would save pictures of him on my phone, and I'd go show my parents this boy, and I'd be like, oh my gosh, we're going to get married at Disneyland. We're going to have two kids, one girl, one boy, Gina and Alexander. And I'm like telling my parents all this, and my mom just laughs in my face. Like, she's like, something's wrong with you. So I'm like, no, nothing's wrong with me. Thanks, Mom. And then she's like, oh, sweetie, you're never going to get with Harry Styles from One Direction. But I was so determined to prove her wrong. Like, I was like, no, Mom, I am going to marry Harry Styles, and nothing is going to stop me. But as I got older, I realized that my love for Harry was a little weird, and I kind of, like, dropped it. Like, I was like, ooh, who's Harry? Ooh. So that's going around. I'm like, ooh, okay. So I'm, like, 17 years old, and, you know, a 17-year-old likes to experiment or whatever. So I met this girl named Danny, and we dated for quite a bit. And she was really nice. I really liked her. She was sweet, but she wasn't my type, which is besides the point. So she was like, if you want to be my girlfriend, you actually have to, like, talk to my two best friends, which is Toby and Richie. And I was like, ooh, okay, I guess I can do that. So I'm like, so I talked to Richie a little bit. He was okay. And then I talked to Toby, and I realized I really liked Toby. Like, he was charming. He was great. He was really good looking, or so I thought at the time. And I'm like, wow, I really like you, but I'm dating your best friend. So I ended up dumping Danny, and, like, a few months later, I was like, hey, kind of have a crush on you. And he's like, oh, that's great, because I have a crush on you, too. And I was like, wow, let's date. So, yeah, so that started. So around November 2014, One Direction had just released their fourth album. So, and then they were like, yeah, we're going to go on tour. And I was like, yeah, oh my gosh, they're going to Seattle. Wow. So I was like, you know, it'd be really great to see Harry again. And I don't know, maybe those feelings might come back. I don't know. So I'm like, so I splurged and I bought fourth row tickets, and they were like $1,600, which is fine. Obviously, I didn't go to college that year. So, so anyway, I'm like, so let me just tell you that, like, July was a good and bad month for me. And I say that because the concert was in July, and I got dumped in July. And so basically what happened was the day before the One Direction concert, I was spending the day with Toby. And it was pretty romantic. I like to think so. Until I looked up, and he had a booger hanging from his nose. And, like, I tried telling him, like, hey, can I have a booger up your nose? And, you know, it's like, hanging. And he was like, no, there isn't. Stop that. And I was like, no, I'm being dead serious. Like, there's a booger in your, like, it's right there. And he was like, no, there's not. And then he tried to kiss me. And I was like, you're not going to kiss me when you have a booger hanging out of your nose. So I'm like, so anyway, so he goes home, and like, so he goes home, and then the next day is the One Direction concert, and I'm like, get myself ready, and I'm like, I gotta look good for Harry. He's probably not gonna notice me because there's gonna be like a million other people there, but that's fine. It's fine. So I'm like, okay. So I'm like at the venue, and you know, my best friend's right next to me, and my cousin and her friend are like on the other side of the stage because I gave them my lame tickets, and so I bought 4 pairs of tickets, by the way. So then I like get this text message like right before the concert starts. And it's Toby, and I'm like, oh, he's probably just going to tell me, like, have a good time. No, it was actually, I want to break things off with you. And I was like, ooh, really? Like, on the day I'm supposed to see Harry, you're going to do that to me? So I called him, and, like, he must have just put his phone down because it went straight to voicemail. And then I started crying, and then I realized, like, I might have left a message in there that was something like, why did you leave me? Did I do something wrong? Was it because I didn't shave my armpits? I swear I'll do it next time. All right. And then I realized, like, wow, that was really embarrassing. And so I'm, like, leaving more messages because I'm, like, trying to get the point, like, why would you dump me? And cause I think I'm pretty great. So anyway, keep that in mind for those. So the concert is, like, just starting, and I'm, like, not focused on it because I'm, like, I just got dumped, and I'm not, like, going to care about 4 attractive boys on stage. But then, like, all of a sudden, like, everybody's screaming around me, and I'm, like, wow, I should really pay attention to, like, what's going on. So I, like, look up, and there he is, and he has, like, long curly brown hair and his beautiful greenish blue eyes and some ugly clothing. I mean, this doesn't count, but, you know, ugly clothing and some pretentious boots from designers. I don't even know how to pronounce their name. And then I realized that, like, Toby really wasn't that important. And I also realized at that moment that, like, Toby was actually never supposed to be my soulmate. I mean, we had promise rings and everything, and we were, you know, getting ready to settle down or whatever. Thank God that didn't happen. Because I realized at 7:49 p.m. Seattle time that Harry Styles is actually my soulmate. So that is my romantic entanglement.
And that's India Busby there from the February Mudrooms. Entangled there. All right, that was fun, Mudroom. A presentation from India Busby, and thanks to the folks at Mudrooms for getting that together and recording that and getting those available to us. It's been such a fun thing for the last few years to have that on the air here on KTOO and KRNN and KXLL. Well, coming up, we're just going to hear a little bit from Bird Note and other events going on out there happening. Of course, it's First Friday, and that's no fooling. It actually is First Friday, so all kinds of stuff happening downtown. Monday, there's going to be a special tasting out at the brewery, and they're looking for folks to make sure that they get their tickets ahead of time, because it's probably going to sell out. So they're going to be tasting out there a 1995 smoke porter, a newer smoke porter, a Perseverance Ale, and a couple of brand new rough drafts. So folks at the brewery, just encouraging you to get out there and do that and get the tickets early if you want to go to that. That's happening Monday night. Also happening Saturday is the Not-So-Silent Silly Shorts. That's happening at both 11 o'clock and 5 p.m. The screening of Skip Shields' movie is happening on April 3rd. And then also there's the presentation tomorrow, Hope Not Heroin, and that's happening from 2 to 6 p.m. at the Jack. Right now, let's hear a short little informational bit about birds. Here's Bird Note.
This is London. This is Bird Note. The critically endangered Eoornis of the Gobi Desert was discovered in the late 1920s by a scientific expedition led by Brigadier General Sir Cecil Weems Cholmondeley. Historically, the species was widespread, according to the expedition's naturalist, Augustus C. Fotheringham. It's been identified in 30,000-year-old cave paintings in France. While in the 18th century, thank God Pillsbury, the doctor on Captain Cook's voyages, records dining on the bird's eggs in the South Seas. It's known informally as the Wuffenpuff because of the sound it makes when it takes off from the desert sand. It is easily recognized in flight by its semicircular wings and characteristic wing whistle, pitched 3 octaves above middle C. Sadly, though, with no adequately documented sightings of the species this century, the Wuffenpuff may well be extinct. One possible reason for its decline was discovered in an experiment Fotheringham conducted. A captive Wuffenpuff, deprived of all sustenance for a week, was set down exactly halfway between 2 equal-sized piles of its favorite fruits. Unable to decide which to eat first, it soon starved to death. Such indecision may have sealed this species' fate forever. For a full description, see Fotheringham's monograph. Begin at our website, birdnote.org.
Support comes from Treadwell Ice Arena, offering an adult hockey clinic March 26th from 4 until 5 p.m. and March 27th from 1:30 until 2:30 p.m. No experience is necessary, and all abilities are welcome. Those interested are encouraged to sign up early. Helmets, breezers, elbow pads, gloves, shin guards, sticks, and jerseys are all available and offered on a first-come, first-served basis. More information at 586-0410.
And that's it for Juno Afternoon for today. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Andy Klein. I've been your host for today, and it's always so fun to be able to do this show every Friday and head into the weekend and find out about all the great stuff that happens here in Juno. See you out there at First Friday, everyone.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org.